Connecting our city and South Cambridgeshire. Cambridge 105 Radio.
Cambridge is right, this sort of thing.
What's it like? Condicious.
Good afternoon and welcome to Flavour. Thanks to Ollie Slack for the football. Now we move on to an hour of food and drink with Alan Alder, our special guest, Carrie Pavitt, and myself, Matt Bentman. And with the 2019 Eat Cambridge Food and Drink Festival only 4 weeks away, here is what's on Flavour today.
James Thorne of Thorne's Wine will be talking about their contributions to this year's festival.
So these sherries certainly suit the more warm, earthy spice from like North Africa or Middle Eastern spice.
Amelie will be talking about their flan couche evening.
I like to say we're the father and son extraordinaire. I love restaurants, I love food. You can do something really beautiful and so simple. If you have the wiseness of, let's say, a father like a Mr. Miyagi in the background, it often helps.
And away from Eat Cambridge, Sue Bailey will continue her selfless samplings of the city's cocktails. Today with Dan Wilson at 2648 in Trinity Street.
And it's done. So you get this nice flavour of the muddled olive in there. Then you get the sweetness of the summer comfort. Then you get the vermouth and Campari, which just marry up so well, and then the tonic finish. So it's very summery. It's very refreshing.
And Heidi White, director of Eat Cambridge, will be giving us an update on what's already sold out and some of the other festival highlights.
A really nice afternoon event to go to, where they'll be pairing lovely Italian dessert wines with the handcrafted Italian desserts that Deborah makes.
And making a welcome return, Dave Fox from Trampington Allotments with some seasonal tips for growers.
But actually, all you need from lettuce is mixed lettuce. That's my top recommendation, because get a couple of packets of that for a season and that'll give you, as it says on the packet, an interesting mixture, different shades of green, nice reds.
We're live here in the studio in Gwydra Street, and you can contact us while we're here by texting 07919 070490, or you can email us at any time on flavour@cambridge105.co.uk. Or send a tweet to @flavour105.
Now, the 2019 Eat Cambridge Food and Drink Festival begins on the 11th of May and runs to the 26th of May. Alan asked Heidi White how things were going.
Yeah, well, it's been quite exciting since we last spoke. The programme came out a couple of weeks ago. Sales have been going really well for some of the ticketed events. And we've got a couple of sellouts already, actually.
That seems pretty early for sellouts.
I know.
To me.
Well, we've got some keen fans that are literally waiting, poised to start clicking as soon as it goes out every year. So Restaurant 22 and their wild tasting menu is now fully booked.
Yeah. Perhaps that's not too much of a surprise, actually. They're generally booked there, aren't they?
Yeah, exactly. And this is a really special one-off dinner they're doing with Seed to Feed, all based on foraged and seasonal produce. So yeah, I'm not surprised that it's sold out so quickly. Hopefully we'll see them do more collaborative events like this later on, because I know a lot of people were disappointed they couldn't get in.
Right.
We also really surprisingly sold out really quickly on one of the free events running at the main event,
of
the sessions.
Yeah, you've said previously these things are free, but it is best to book.
Best to book, yeah. So we've got some workshops and panel sessions running at the main event alongside the food and drink fair. For the first time, we ticketed them to try and get an idea of how many people we could fit in the council chamber, just get a feel for how many people are interested in these. And ticket sales are going really, really fast. And the styling workshop sold out in about 5 days. So all of the places are gone for that one.
That was both styling and photography, wasn't
it?
Yeah,
food styling and food photography.
With Stella Pereira.
Yeah, with Stella Pereira and then a local photographer, Charlotte Griffiths. And they've got some really good plans for laying out a gorgeous feast and then talking the guests through how to actually style and take pictures.
Yeah, well, Stella's work in that is fantastic, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's extraordinary.
Beautiful
actually.
Photos. Yeah, she took some really great photos for the festival, actually, of me and Rosie Sykes. And during those sessions, she took some lovely styled shots of books and bowls of food and teapots on the table, and it's just effortless what she creates. It's amazing.
The thing with tickets that don't cost anything is people don't always turn up.
Yeah, so we will be holding some spaces for people to just walk in on the day, because we're well aware that that will happen. So I guess what we're saying is just get in early if you want to try and be a walk-in on the day. And we'll squeeze in as many people as we can.
Right, OK.
Yeah.
Now, when I was looking through the brochure, which looks very good to me, elegant, nicely laid out. I mean, we talked last time about beer, about like the tap takeover at Pint Shop, for example. But there's quite a few wine events going on as well. In fact, quite a few.
Yeah, definitely. So it's interesting, during May, there's quite a lot going on the drinks front. National Wine Day coincides with the festival this year. So Mark from Cambridgeshire Wine School decided to put on a specific tasting based around that celebration, with a lunch as well as a wine tasting. And his events are always really thorough.
And he's very entertaining as well, isn't he?
Yeah, definitely. He's got a lot of experience on the teaching side. So I'm not sure how exactly he will be celebrating National Wine Day, but I'm sure there'll be some treats in there, some more unusual wines perhaps, and some quizzes along the way. And then there's also a new event this year from Thorn Wines. They've teamed up with Pint Shop to create a sherry masterclass. So James from Thorn Wines will be talking through some sherries to be paired with food on a 6-course tasting menu that Pint Shop will create.
And Cambridge Cookery have got a wine event.
Yeah, they've got a wine tasting. It's on a Friday night, and they have their Friday night wine bar anyway, so it's always a really nice vibe there in the bistro. They have tapas that they'll match to different wines. They'll do a tutored tasting. It's all about the big red wines from Piemonte. They've got some great connections with small producers of the wines from that region, and then they encourage people to stay on afterwards, enjoy some wines and tapas, and just generally enjoy the feel of their neighbourhood bistro. It's a lovely spot, actually, in the evening. Really lovely.
And Maurizio in Mill Road has an event.
Yes. So this is a bit more of a relaxed experience, which runs throughout the festival on each of the Saturdays. So it'll be running on 3 Saturdays. You get to join Maurizio himself for aperitivo and to taste the 2 different fizzes that they stock. So
Franciacorta and Prosecco.
Versus Prosecco.
Yeah.
So, yeah, they have 2 Italian fizz on offer. Maurizio will do a taste test with guests to see what the difference is and learn about how the different Italian fizzes are made. And they'll also have some little bites of food to match. It's a really relaxed a really relaxed place there, so it should be fun. But they do ask that you book in advance.
Okay.
You can contact to book via their website. And another really great event that's new for this year is a collaboration with Biscotti di Debora and a local Italian wine importer who are new to the scene called Vine and Cork. They're putting on a dessert wine pairing masterclass called Dolce e Vino. It's on Sunday the 19th of May at the Cambridge Cookery School. So a really nice afternoon event to go to, where they'll be pairing lovely Italian dessert wines with the handcrafted Italian desserts that Debora makes.
With lovely Italian desserts, yes.
Yeah, it sounds amazing.
What's a lovely way to spend a Sunday
exactly
afternoon.
It sounds amazing just because of what you'll be sipping and eating, but also the 2 businesses behind it, Vine and Cork and Biscotti di Debora, have such years of passion and heritage behind them. They'll have some real stories to tell during the event, I think.
Excellent.
Yeah, so I would get booking for that one as soon as possible.
And also, there's a pop-up shop in Eltisley Avenue in Newnham as well, in which there will be wine.
Yes, definitely, because where Susanna of Hum Closen goes, wine and cheese always follow. Susanna's opening a great little shop in Newnham, which will be a local foodie haven by the sounds of it. She's yet to release who exactly she'll be stocking, but it's definitely a collaboration with different producers and different local sellers and suppliers of top quality ingredients. So that will be running throughout the whole festival fortnight.
Will it? Right.
Yeah, she will have the opening hours posted up on the website, on the Hum Closen website.
Right, good. Okay, well, thank you very much,
Heidi.
Thank you.
And that was Heidi White.
Anything you're especially looking forward to, Karen?
Oh, for me, it's being able to experience the diversity of the Cambridge food scene, from Rosie Sykes' collaboration supper at the start to the huge number of producers under one roof at the main event, I think.
Yeah, well, that starting supper sounds fantastic to me. I hope to be there.
Now, the Alsace region in France borders Germany and Switzerland. We've talked about this region a few times on Flavour in the past because Frank Ponan of La Maison du Steak on Hills Road is from there. Now we have another entrant with Alex and his family who run Amelie Flammkuchen in the Grafton Centre.
Flammkuchen is an old dish the Amelie team are intending to revitalise. Here's Alex with more, including Amelie's involvement in this year's Eat Cambridge Food Festival.
Well, I was born in the kitchen. I was born with a ladle in my mouth, sitting on the kitchen countertops, just watching my father cook, and my mother was always front of house, but I was obsessed with it.
This is Alex. He and his father are professional cooks. The family hail from France. The father, Reggie, worked in the Michelin restaurants on the continent before moving to the UK 30 years ago to learn English and to run a business here, the Great House in Lebanon, which is featured in the top 50 longest-lasting establishments in the Good Food Guide, and it's won Michelin forks and AA rosettes.
The great thing of working with him is really the fact that he's got experience. He's had 3, 4, 5 successful restaurants in the past. He knows how tough the market is. It's not a family business where you've got the mother working in the back making the pastry and the sister in the front making front of house as well. Although it would be great doing that, it's just it's not our goal. And our goal is to bring forward Amelie.
Amelie, that's the name of this business.
So it's Amelie Flammkuchen Restaurants with an S at the end because we're ambitious. Often we'll say Amelie Restaurants because it's Amelie. A lot of people do just say Amelie Restaurants because Flammkuchen is still a word that's not known to them. Or Amelie Flammkuchen, as we call it in the family. Amelie being named after my sister.
There's that word again, Flammkuchen. What is Flammkuchen? So here I am behind the counter with Alex, and you're just about to make some.
So I'm going to make a Flammkuchen. I'll make the authentic, which is the most traditional one that we have. We start off with the base, which is flour, water, a little bit of rapeseed oil, and nothing else. There's no yeast or anything, unlike quite often people will see a pizza. And visually it does look a lot like pizza, but it's going to be a lot lighter and a lot thinner, and you get a lot more flavours from the top.
So like a pizza, but not actually a pizza. This is made with dough rolled very, very thin, and it cooks rapidly. They therefore translate Flammkuchen as French fire bread.
After that, I've put on creme fraiche. So it's creme fraiche seasoned with a bit of salt and pepper, and it's a low-fat creme fraiche as well. Low-fat's always better, cooks better, and is a lot lighter on your body. Next, we have some very thin smoked bacon. We spread that all on top. So traditionally in Alsace in the 14th century, what bakers used to do to test their ovens out, they would roll a very, very thin piece of bread dough. And the bread dough would be so thin that the second it would cook, the bakers would know that their ovens were ready to start cooking their bread. Realizing after a while that they were wasting a piece of bread, they were like, okay, well, let's use this to eat. Let's do something with it. But it's so, we need to cover it with something so that it's nice to eat. And being in Alsace where there's nothing but pigs, cows, grass and flour. So they got some cream from the cows and some pork from the pigs. And that was it. That was when the Flammkuchen originated from. So unlike pizza, which was very much on tomato base in the Mediterranean, these completely different flavours. This is a very rustic dish from Alsace and kind of went dead for a while and is now starting to be rejuvenated, especially in France, Germany, Austria. It's very, very popular over there. And then finally, we cover it with a bit of Gruyère cheese. Gruyère being a bit sweeter than your traditional cheddar, a bit more flavour than mozzarella. And that's it. That is literally the authentic.
Okay.
Goes in the oven, cooks for 90 seconds, and it's with you. From ordering it to it being in front of you, we're looking at not more than 3 minutes.
And in that time, the oven has to be super hot, doesn't it?
Yeah. So the oven is at about 330 degrees normally. These are pizza ovens, stone-baked pizza ovens. It does cook, but they're very delicate. Hence, we called it after my sister, because she's very delicate as a girl.
And here is the finished product.
You just slice it up. Cambridge itself loves to have chains, makes it a little bit more difficult for smaller people to come in.
With the goal of making Flem Cuish a household name, Alex and his father searched 150 sites around England before settling on Cambridge, and a new initiative set up by the Grafton Centre to welcome in independent food businesses.
We had the opportunity with this unit where they didn't really want to trust us, and they felt like independence would be a good side, especially on this side of Cambridge, and we thought we'd go for it, really. So originally we were actually thinking of opening maybe something meaty, but Flem Cuish kept on coming up, and we had this passion for Flem Cuish. We love the idea of this flatbread that's a lot lighter than pizza, but a lot of flavour still. It's a little bit healthier. You feel that it's a lot lighter. You don't feel bloated afterwards because there's no yeast in it.
Does it feel very different to everything that your parents have done so far? And also your father's reaction to this, because, you know, it's not a restaurant per se. It is.
Ah. No, but you're right. It's true. It's very difficult. Well, they're used to white tablecloths and fine glassware and a French style of service. But here, yeah, it's very different. But it's the environment we wanted to go in. We wanted to completely scrap everything. The benefit here for any employee or any customer is that you don't have to think too much. When you walk in, you have a very restricted wine list, because quite often, if you just want to have a quick, nice meal, it's what's the house wine? So we've got a couple of whites, a couple of reds, and one rosé. Same with the beers. The glasses are all the same, so that you don't have to train the waiter and be like, okay, this is for this, this is for that. It's just simple. And the glassware is actually for wine. It's just got no stem. It's a Spanish tapas glass. There's the nicest feeling, and I think anyone you ask in hospitality, whether you're born in it or whether you have a passion for it, is when you give someone a dish, and it does sound very cliche, but it's true. When you give someone a dish and they have their first bite and they look up to whoever they're eating with, look up and smile. And they know, you just know that you've done something right. And I think anyone in hospitality is going to agree with that. And I think if you've got that feel inside of you and you've got that passion to make someone smile like that, then it's a good industry for you. And yeah, you're willing to put the hours in. We are participating in Eat Cambridge. Again, another thing that the independents in Cambridge are doing. And I think it's fantastic to be part of. I know that on the main event, my father will be talking with Alex Rushmer, Rosie Sykes, Tristan Welsh, and Liz Young. And that's a panel discussion. My father's really looking forward to being part of that. He loves a good panel. He loves a good discussion. And our event, which is on the 23rd of May, it's an evening event from 6:30. We'll have a couple of drinks, start off with, it's just for people to discover Flem Cuish. We'll be doing a selection of 10 different Flem Cuish. My father will be talking in between. I mean, he's a lot better at talking than I am. He's got a French accent. 10 different types of Flem Cuish, taking you through a journey of how we first started to where we got to, and really showing how the Flem Cuish is authentically in Alsace. We do have the authentic Flem Cuish on the menu, but even that has been elaborated a little bit to be suited to the British market. Alsatians often come here and they think, well, it's not really an authentic, but it is. Look, I mean, you've got to sell what people like. Whether you've got an idea or concept in mind, you've got to make sure that when you're selling it, people are actually happy to buy it. And where you come from, you know that product so well, and that authenticity, you're always going to produce it with love and passion. And that's what my father did at the Great House and all his restaurants. They always had the French flair. All the service was French, all the chefs were French. It was French cooking, but with English ingredients. Everything was British. And I think that just was a really good mix, because you had all these local flavours, but cooked a bit differently.
So Alex, thanks very much. We are here at Amelie at the far end of the Grafton Centre. This is up on the first floor, just opposite the cinema entrance. Your opening times?
Every day from 11:30, before coffees and little nibbles from 10:30. And during the week, we are open till 8. And Fridays and Saturdays, 9. And then on a Sunday, 5:30.
Lovely. Thank you very much, Alex.
Thank you very much.
There we go. I've been a pizza fan all of my 21 years, and I would not describe these as pizzas. You know, it's that dough. It's so thin and it's so light, and it has kind of the thickness of a cream cracker, but with the delicacy of a millefeuille that you'd get from a bakery. I tried the traditional Flem Cuish that Alex made in that feature, and I loved it. With that creme fraiche and the other fresh toppings, it really went down easy, and I did feel full without feeling stuffed.
And they're serving a variety of toppings to choose from, including prawns, spinach and ricotta, parma ham, pulled pork, all of that with the creme fraiche, onion, olives, tomato and everything else. And there's veggie options in there as well. With such a quick turnaround from ordering to ready, they're well equipped to handle increasing numbers at the Grafton Grafton's new food social area as it fills up with even more independent food outlets.
And they've been there a good few months now, and Alex says that things are going very well. Amelie's website, if you'd like to check out the Flancouche, is amelierestaurants.co.uk.
And here's news of some free food available now in and around Cambridge, which you can find on the Olio app.
Yes, the Olio app, as we hope you all know now, is a free to download on iOS and Android app. Using your location, it'll tell you the free food that is nearest to you. And this weekend, get ready for it, everything is gone. This is the first time we've had this message. It may suggest to the app's popularity. However, do check out the Olio app during the week because you can find some truly excellent offers. And you can pick up these offers from food champions. Now, these are people who act as collection points around the city, which make it even more convenient for you to pick up. So that's Olio, the free food app for all food in and around Cambridge. Well, the country, really, but we are focusing on Cambridge.
A new name at Eat Cambridge this year is Fawn Wines. They're involved in two events. Alan spoke with co-founder James Fawn.
James, you're doing a couple of events at this year's Eat Cambridge. Could you tell us what they are?
We're going to be showcasing a few of our wines at the main event. We will also be doing, excitingly, a sherry and food pairing masterclass at Pint Shop. So we have teamed up with the Pint Shop to create a 6-course menu, and we're going to do 7 drinks, a welcome drink made from sherry, and then 6 sherries of different styles to show off the versatility of the wine, its ability to pair with food, and also just how underrated the wine is.
But you've got 6 sherries, so what, they're different, 6 different styles of sherry?
Correct, yes. So sherry does have that classic stigmatism of being grandma or granddad's drink. My grandparents certainly enjoyed a glass of sherry, but it's something that has been a bit misunderstood over the years in our country, and especially because we are quite common to having cream sherries put in front of us, when actually there are dry sherries, there are nutty, rich, oxidized sherries, there are extremely sweet sherries, and then obviously that medium cream style in between. But the main thing with sherry is the fact that it's aged for so long. So we, what we'll be doing is be showing how a rich sherry or a nutty and dry sherry can pair perfectly with something with spice to it. Or, for example, a really nice, fresh and vibrant Fino sherry can pair so well with fried foods or with hams or dry or cured meats.
So the sherries that pair well with spicy foods, you don't get sherry offered in Indian restaurants too often, do you?
No, you don't. But
is that something that they're missing out on?
I probably would say so, because actually when you look at the history of sherry and the history of Spain, the Moors were the people that actually took over a lot of the area, and a lot of the oxidized style of wine, actually once it's had that aging and that oxidation, pairs perfectly with spice because it can take it. A lot of people will pair a dry wine with curry or anything spicy because they'll think that, oh, it's refreshing, it's easy, but actually it heightens the acidity and makes it a little bit harsher. So these sherries, because they've got slight sweetness in some of them, or they've got a little bit more richness through aging, they can take that spice, but they certainly suit the more warm earthy spice from like North Africa or Middle Eastern spice.
Well, things like cinnamon.
Exactly, yeah. Cinnamon, things like coriander, actually cardamom, any floral herbal spices as well. It's such a versatile wine.
Yeah, and the Fino sherry, you say, goes well with fried foods.
Yes.
Because, it just cuts through the fat?
Exactly, yeah. It's such a fresh and vibrant style. We actually have quite a few customers now who used to say, oh, I don't like sherry. But actually, once you put the right sherry in front of someone, they will appreciate it more, and they'll expect, maybe I can try this style, or I can try this style. And Fino can be one of the styles that can really suit people, because you get that lovely classic white wine style, but there's just a hint of the yeasty characteristic that can be in as part of a sherry. But with a really good Enrama Fino, which is something that we're going to be showing at the tasting, they have a little bit of fruitiness and weight to them that takes away that yeasty characteristic. So it's fresh, vibrant and juicy to an extent. So it'll work really, really well with fried fish. I'm tempted to say that it's going to work well with something like the onion bardi scotch egg that Pint Shop have done in the past. And there's even just on its own, with nuts, with ham, just absolutely dreamy. Mm. It's so refreshing.
Some sherries, to me at any rate, don't drink well by themselves, like some Olorosos, for example. Mm-hmm. And I sometimes wonder whether sherry hasn't been... hasn't really taken off in this country because people like to drink something without food. Does that seem likely?
It is very much so. And Olorosos, because they're much richer and much more intense, they definitely need something to pair with them. You can find some younger Olorosos that will work nicely just on their own, and they'll be designed to be drunk on their own in some cases, but most of the time the way that they'd be drunk in Spain is with some food. Even if it's just a little tapa, just a simple nibble. Just the ability to balance a wine is amazing when you have it with the right food. So I'd completely agree with you. There are certainly some that will work and some that won't for drinking on their own.
Yeah. Right, so this is an event that you're putting on with Pint Shop, and there are six courses, you say?
Yes.
Yeah, that's extraordinary.
Yeah, so and especially at the price. We are basically looking to celebrate sherry. Yeah. We're wanting to show off, obviously, everything that the Pint Shop can do with their kitchen and some of the dishes that they've done in the past, some of their all-time favourites with a twist. And then, obviously, we've got these amazing sherries to put together with them. And we're talking about wines from some of the oldest wineries in the world. Some of them are 400 years old, and some of these sherries are going to be average age of 30 years old. So they're extremely good value for money when you take into account how old they are.
Absolutely, yeah. And you've also got a presence at the big event as well, haven't you, for Eat Cambridge?
We do.
And I noticed that in the programme it says, not just the norm, wine in beer bottles. That's extraordinary.
Yeah, so what's been quite impressive in the last sort of 2 years is that a few winemakers have gone out there and they've kind of tried to break convention a little bit and turn things on their head by putting wine in beer bottles, in cans, and... As an outsider, you'd probably look at it and say, it's just a gimmick. But actually, these are two pretty much inert vessels, so they work perfectly for fresh, young wines. Champagne, for centuries, has been made under crown cap closure, which is the cap that you'd have on a beer bottle. And the champagne would rest in the cellars for 3 to 4 years under that closure. So there's no reason why we can't do that in a smaller format. Now, when my wife was pregnant, it was the perfect format because it was a beer bottle. Okay, it's a 500ml bottle, but I was finding that I could never get through a full bottle of wine myself. And just the ability to be able to crack open a white or a red that's juicy, easygoing, just kind of a reliable wine at a sensible price point, and finish it or get close to finishing it without having the sort of repercussions the following day, the wine flu that happens the next day.
And you've also got orange wine as well.
Yeah.
Can you tell us a bit about orange wine?
It's an industry or an area in the industry that's really up and coming. And it's all about when you make a white wine, you're making it in the style of a red wine. So a red wine will stay, the grapes will stay, once they've been crushed, they'll stay on their skins for a period of about a week to 2 weeks, depending on what area in the world the wine's being made. And by doing that, you're getting colour. Do the same with a white grape, you get the colour from the skins. So it becomes this orangey, golden hue. And then orange wine has more of a natural sort of vibe to it as well. A lot of the people making it will do natural yeasts or indigenous yeasts. They will unfilter, they'll unfine it. So you get more of those golden, rich and orangey colours. And with that, you're getting a characteristic of wine that sort of sits between a white wine and a red wine because it has the texture of a red, but some of the flavour profiles of a white wine. Actually, when you look at sherries, they're not too dissimilar. The only difference really with the sherry is that it's oxidised and it's not had the skin contact. The colour has changed because it's had a lot of air in contact with it to make it almost turn. It's an area that I've found really exciting. And for pairing with food, these wines are beautiful. They really have so much character to them, but they stand up to some quite robust flavours.
What, such as?
Take your classic Sunday roast. If you make a bisto gravy, it's probably not going to be the thing. But if you were to take the sticky brown roasting tin base that you get left from having it made a chicken, roasting a chicken, and you were to add a bit of water to that, reduce that down to a really, really intense gravy. If you were to put that with a nice white burgundy or another like Chardonnay, they're going to work okay. But there's going to become a point where that sauce, that gravy, is too rich. So throwing in an orange wine into this environment, it can take it. It's got tannins, it's got a bit more structure and a bit more power. But really, they also do drink amazingly well on their own. They're becoming quite popular because of how versatile they are.
How popular?
I'd say it's still the hipster market. It's that young, funky vibe going to it. But it's something that's going to be seen a lot more in restaurants. On wine lists that I see now, there's an orange wine section. They might not be the best-selling wines on there, but people who like wine like to explore things. They like to try different
Absolutely,
styles.
Yeah. And you're supplying Van der Lyle.
We are, yes.
With orange wines?
There is a skin contact white, but I wouldn't call it or classify it as an orange wine as such. But they've gone down a very natural, low-intervention, sustainable route. So with their principles and how they're working the restaurant, they've made sure that follows in with their wines. And it's been such a pleasure to play around and find some wines that suit their list.
Yeah, I bet it has. But back to the main events, are you, obviously you're selling bottles of wine at the main event, but are you offering tastings as well?
So we, at the main event, we'll have all of the wines that we have there open to try.
Right.
And then obviously it kind of leads into what we like to do outside of these sort of events, where we can do at home tastings, or we can showcase these sort of wines in smaller environments for businesses. And it just, we want to show ourselves and show what we love.
Yeah, that was James Thorne of Thorne Wines there. And I've not had an orange wine, have either of you?
I don't think I have, or not that I can remember.
Right, well, something to look forward to. Thorne Wines is one of the suppliers of wine to Van der Lyle, where I went on Thursday night.
How did you find it?
I found it astonishing. The food was astonishing. My wife had the flight of soft drinks. They were astonishing. There's a lovely atmosphere in there, there's space, but it's not sort of so laid back, it hasn't got any energy, it has energy.
Yeah.
Alex comes and explains each dish to you so you can get, you know, even more out of it. I think it's a marvellous place. You've been, haven't
yes,
you, Harry?
Yes, and you can taste the passion in the food, and the kind of the atmosphere is just nicely relaxed. It's not intense passion, it's just lovely kind of sort of chilled.
A success, yeah, lovely.
Well, more drinks now. Sue Bailey has been to find out about cocktails at 2648 in Trinity Street. If you don't know where that is, it's on the same side as the Trinity and the Ivy, and it's underground in the spot previously occupied by the Vaults. Sue spoke to General Manager Dan Wilson.
Why a number?
The actual name 2648 actually comes from the original number from the Motown Records studio. So that's where that sort of originates from.
It's quite a hidden location, isn't it, in Trinity Street?
It is very hidden. We've only got a little A-frame, a little door, so you have to sort of look for it. Some people get a little bit lost, but when they find it, they absolutely love the place.
What would you say you're best known for? Cocktails?
Cocktails, yeah, definitely. And also with our sort of Friday and Saturdays with DJs, because we do a lot of house nights, techno nights. We even do rockabilly nights, reggaeton nights, reggae nights, and hip-hop nights as well. So we've got quite a variation in our music.
You do food as well as cocktails, don't you?
Yes, we've got a residency at the moment, which is Reggae Kitchen. So both of my chefs come from Jamaica. That's 100% authentic Caribbean food. You won't find anything like it in Cambridge, not really. So, and then tying in with our sort of new menu that we've got coming in, we've got Caribbean cocktails to go with the food and complement.
Tell me a bit more about the cocktails. Start off with the Caribbean ones.
So with the Caribbean ones, we decided instead of just basing all the cocktails from sort of Jamaica, we've chosen 5 different islands. So we're doing drinks based on their sort of national favourite cocktails. We've got like an Antigua Smile, obviously, which is from Antigua. Then we've got obviously the Pina Colada as well, which we're keeping on there. We've got the Bahama Mama from Bahamas. So they're quite obviously more based in the rum. You know, they're very sort of sweet, summery. You know, you have a sip, you just want to be on a beach.
And I gather you personally are quite involved in going in for competitions.
So I've been bartending just over 4 years now, and my good friend Sean Cambridge was one that brought me into the actual bar industry, and he sort of pushed me and my love for him chefing, because I trained as a chef. It was quite easy to transfer over them sort of knowing flavour, taste, presentation into cocktails, and I've done very well. About 2 years ago, I was put into top 50 in UK world class. Same year, I also represented the UK against the rest of the world for Skinos Mystia.
What's
Skinos Mystia? So Skinos Mystia is a heritage product that comes from the island of Chios in Greece. So basically it's a resin which they derive from this tree, and then they add sugar, water, alcohol and distill. So it's got like notes of cucumber, herbs. It's very different. It's very unique in flavour and taste. But you can still find it in the UK. It's a little bit harder to find, but it's very unusual.
And you created your standout cocktail for the UK in this national competition.
I've also, when we did the Cambridge Cocktail Weekend, the first one, I was runner-up in that one. I've also run my own cocktail competitions in the city for the other bartenders. So there's a lot of camaraderie between the bars. So we learn, grow, educate each other as well, which is the best thing. Because at the end of the day, it's about pushing forward with representing Cambridge against the rest of the world and nationally as well.
How would you say Cambridge stands out as a sort of cocktail destination?
It's definitely on the up, because I said like a lot more people are realising, studying a lot more. But like before, you know, it was sort of there, but it wasn't predominant. But with these sort of national and international competitions that myself and a few other people are doing, sort of making people notice Cambridge a little bit more, and it's sort of flagging up a bit more, which is fantastic to see.
So tell me a bit more about your personal signature cocktails. What do you put in them?
Well, when I first started, I tried to go a little bit more complex and try and do a lot more things differently. But as I've started to sort of progress, I find that less is more. So the best drinks that you'll find in the world will have like 3-4 ingredients in. One of my first signature and international drinks I did, which represented Martell, so they're the oldest cognac house to date, and they wanted a bartender to represent each year, and I'm one of them 300 bartenders in the world. And it was Le Bouche Real, which was Martell VS, and it was Woodford's Reserve, Campari, orange marmalade, then lime, sugar and egg white just shaken, and just served straight on the rocks. So it's quite bold, quite flavoursome, but a little bit out there.
Tell me about one or two other ones.
So at the moment, me and my colleague Tom, we're waiting to find out about this Southern Comfort competition. So we've just got our entries in a couple of days ago, so we find out next month if we go through to the UK final. And if we go past the UK final, then we go obviously to New Orleans for a week. One of us will. If we both get through, it might be both of us. Might get in trouble for that one.
That'd be fun.
But I've sort of gone down the route of my love for things Mediterranean and aperitivo style. So I've obviously got Southern Comfort there, 30 mils of that. Then I've got 30 mils Otto Zaffin Vermouth, which obviously comes from Athens. So when the king decided to move the capital, he actually moved it to obviously Athens itself. And he actually commissioned for a distillery to be made, and this is where Otto's vermouth comes from. And it has olive leaf in there as part of the botanicals. It's one of the best vermouths that I've personally tasted.
What's it called again?
Otto's Athens vermouth. Okay. I've got muddled olives in there. Obviously, I've got 30 mils of Southern Comfort, 30 mils of the Otto's Athens vermouth, 10 mils of Campari, again, a Mediterranean product from Italy. And then it's just shaken, fine-strained, top Mediterranean fever tree tonic. And it's done. So you get this nice flavour of the muddled olive in there. Then you get the sweetness of the Southern Comfort. Then you get the vermouth and Campari, which just marry up so well, and then the tonic finish. So it's very summery. It's very refreshing. It's actually going on our new menu, which we're going to be launching in about 3-4 weeks as well.
I was going to ask you, you know, because some of your drinks sound amazing, but do you test them on the customers? Do the customers get a chance to try them?
We do test our customers. Like, generally, obviously, we have our menu, which we set. If people ask off stuff sort of not on there, we're more than happy to make it. Or, you know, if they want us to try and come up with something just on their sort of preference. So sometimes we get people going, I don't know what I'd like. So you go, well, would you like sweet, sour, bitter, savoury? So they'll tell you sort of aspect of that. And then you go, what spirits do you like or don't you like? So they'll go vodka or they'll go tequila or this, that. And so we basically create the drink to what they're telling us and to their sort of palate that they want to drink. So that's a lot more fun for us because we get a little bit more creative, a little bit more crazy sometimes.
What about the whole non-alcoholic cocktail scene?
Non-alcoholic, I find with some places it is a lot of fruit juices. We've actually got a non-alcoholic section coming onto our menu. We're not doing fruit juices, we're not doing non-alcoholic mojitos. If people want to ask for them, we're more than happy, but we're going to go a little bit more out of the box. So we're making our own shrubs. So for people that don't know what shrub is, it's basically fruit, sugar or vegetables and sugar, and it brings out like a syrup from there. And then you can add in your own sort of vinegars. So we're going to be looking at making our own vinegar in the future. But for one, what do we got? It's basically strawberry, raspberry, black pepper, balsamic vinegar, and we use a shot and a half of that topped with soda, fresh strawberry, fresh raspberry. It may sound weird to a few people, but you try it, it's so summery, so refreshing. It's a lot more different, as I said, than these fruit juices that you just see. You've got people like Seedlip, which are obviously pushing forward with like the Negroni, so no alcohol in there, but it tastes very similar to a Negroni. Espresso Martini as well. So I think as well, like, there needs to be more options for people that don't want to drink, but they want to still drink cocktails. So it's very important. This is why we're doing a nice little section where they're proper cocktails. They're not mocktails. They're cocktails with no alcohol.
Oh, well, thank you so much, Dan. I really enjoyed talking to you.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Thank you.
And that was Dan Wilson from 2648 in Trinity Street. It's open every night from 5 till late, and there is a happy hour from 5 till 9, and all evening on Mondays. And there's the music that signals time for the latest food tweets from the city.
Yeah, just a couple of quickies today. Relevant Records, they've been open from 6 this morning because it's Record Store Day. And they've got live music until 6 tonight with food. And Mill Road Butchers is taking orders for Easter now, and that includes Norfolk Saltmarsh Lamb Ballantine with sausage meat and a leek.
On now to growing your own fruit and vegetables. Alan went on a cold, windy day last week to speak with Dave Fox, our man at the allotment.
Dave, a lot to be done.
Absolutely, Alan. It's that time of year when almost everything needs sowing. So I've already put out onions, potatoes, chard, beetroot, carrot, radish, broad beans, peas, probably lots more that I can't remember because I've got to go away for a bit, so I've got to get a lot of seed in the ground now. But also we're getting to the point where you want to start sowing the summer crops indoors, so tomatoes, pumpkins, squash, cucumber, peppers, which we won't plant out until the end of May when it's a lot warmer, but you want to get them started off now. So there is a lot to do. By the way, a top tip for lettuce is I've got some seeds in the pocket here. I always go overboard and order far too many varieties: Red Sails, Webb's Wonderful, Lettony, all sorts. But actually, all you need from lettuce is mixed lettuce. That's my top recommendation, because get a couple of packets of that for a season and that'll give you, as it says on the packet, an interesting mixture, different shades of green, nice reds, frilly, smooth, cost types, open leaf types, butterhead types, and you get one of those and make a nice big mixed salad, a terrific variety on the table. So
I'm just amused by the back of this seed pack. Contains 1,200 seeds and it costs £1.35. Now, how much does a single lettuce cost in a shop, I wonder? You certainly wouldn't get 1,200.
So tenth of a penny per seed. Well, that's if they all germinate, of course.
But it also says sow February to July, so there's still a good amount of time as well.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, although you've got to look back to last season, which was super hot and dry, and that would not be a good season for lettuce unless they had a really favourable microclimate, by which I mean partly shaded and, you know, with some either really good moisture retentive soil or a source of water, because lettuces get stressed, and as soon as they start to think they're going to run out of, you know, moist environment, they'll shoot off and make a flower spike and seed, and at that point they're no good for leaf. So I suppose that points to the general principle that you want you should aim in the garden to plant lots of different types of crops. Because last summer, 2018, showed us that some things just simply aren't going to do very well. You can't possibly get enough water on them to keep a summer crop of lettuce going, for example.
Right, so you don't want to be over-reliant on one particular...
Yeah, that's right. And, I mean, it's not that many years ago. 2012 was an extraordinarily wet summer. We barely saw any sun that year, and lots of things failed. We got diseases on potatoes that we hadn't seen before. I certainly hadn't seen before. Blackleg on the potatoes, yeah. Mm. So... yeah, I mean, obviously you want to choose things that you like to eat. And that's another top tip for new growers. you can read through the gardening book, and it says, you know, sort of, I don't know, cauliflower is a satisfying vegetable to grow, but you know, it takes 12 months for overwintering cauliflower, and it's a lot of work. There's a lot of things can go wrong in 12 months. So if you don't like cauliflower, don't spend 12 months growing it. If there's any newbies listening to this, I'd suggest early potatoes, broad beans, runner beans, lettuce and radish for your salads. They're fairly surefire.
Is it still a bit early for sowing runner beans?
Yes.
Right.
You could sow some inside, just about, and plant out early, but it's only in the indoor growing environment I've got. They tend to get a bit leggy. I don't have a brilliantly well lit environment. If you had a greenhouse, maybe start them off in there.
So they're susceptible to frost.
That's the problem. Yeah.
But broad beans are okay.
Correct. Yeah. Broad beans are good with frost. The ones we're looking at here, actually, these are Acqua Dolce broad beans, which went in November. And probably poked their heads above ground 1st of January or something, and they're looking pretty healthy. Okay, so here's one plant which has got darkened edges on the leaves, suggesting frost damage. I wonder why one of them has been damaged by frost, and it's smaller as well, so I probably did fill in a few gaps where the original sowing had missed, and that looks like one of the second sowing, so maybe there was a fairly hard frost came along when the when those plants were young, and the others had got toughened up. You see the little semicircular holes in the edges of the leaf. That's the flea beetle eating away.
Well, they don't seem to eat very much, so that's...
We let them live. Let them get away with it. Let's move on and see what we've got.
So the fact that the weather is really... this month and last has been quite variable, hasn't it, with some very hot spells, unseasonably hot spells,
and also some
quite cold spells. So what's the advice? I mean, are the things that you would normally sow in April going to tolerate that sort of range of conditions?
I think we just have to put a good variety of different crop types in and see what the season brings. I did come out and make some speculative early sowings in that ridiculously warm week in February. Today it's just a little bit cold, and this wind is very drying as well. So you forget, if you're a plant out here or a little seedling out here all day, you're going to lose quite a lot of moisture to this wind, even though it's not particularly sunny. I've got this bed mulched until the bolotti beans go in. And we mentioned earlier about potentially sowing things like runner beans inside. You can do that try and get an early crop. I find it much easier to put those beans in the ground 1st of May, and hopefully they come up day after the last frost and get away to a good start. So this bed I can leave until then, and it will be reasonably weed free and also very fertile, because it's got 6 inches of organic matter on top, and under there hopefully lots of earthworms and other creatures helping to break it down and take the organic matter into the soil. So this is part of my sort of no dig, or actually low dig regime, whereas instead of turning the soil over for weed control and to dig in manure, you just put the organic matter on top and let nature take its course. Looks a bit more untidy than the digging regime, but it's certainly less work overall for the human, more work for the earthworms. I think that's a good good equation.
So you also increase the number of earthworms, presumably.
Absolutely, yeah.
What about things like onions? If you haven't put onions in, have you missed the boat?
No, it's still plenty of time to sow onions, both sets and seed. They can go in for the next month or so. Can you see the onions that I've sowed recently?
There's
two beds.
Are there? No, I can't.
Okay, so if you look at the mesh tunnel to our left and the area of mesh to our right. And I've put in a couple of rows of red onions and yellow onion sets under each of those. And the reason why they're covered with mesh is to keep off the dreaded allium leaf miner, which is this relatively new pest. And so the way to protect it is to cover it with this very fine mesh that's small enough holes to keep out the winged pest. That will keep them off until the end of April, and then the mesh can come off and let the onions get away and get nice and big, because you know the problem with covering crops with a net, it does tend to restrict the growth, and it potentially would lead to fungal diseases. So you might, whilst keeping off the pest, you might have some other problem with the crop. There's yet another bed of field beans. So most of these I will cut back to keep the nitrogen.
Actually, this one's in flower as well.
Yeah. Oh my goodness, they're flowering already. Okay, so yeah, that's it. Where are we? Early April. Yeah, that's a month early. You can't say that any particular year is indicative of climate change, but I think the evidence is mounting up. It's heavy circumstantial evidence that the climate's changing. It's using up its store of resources, which I'm trying to keep in the ground. So maybe that means I need to cut those actually now before I go away. I will leave one patch of my field beans to flower and produce seed, because I want to have lots of field beans to sow this autumn in order to store more nitrogen. I'm just gradually increasing my stock of beans as I go. Yeah. But thanks for spotting that these were flowering. That I just wouldn't have even occurred to me to check for flowering so soon. But I suppose now that I looked at it, you can see some of the plants are really getting quite tall. So that's always the indicator that they're starting to change their chemistry and what they're doing. The question is, will there be enough bees and everybody else on the wing to pollinate them? Probably will be.
And that was Dave Fox bravely battling the wind at Trumpington Allotments. And that is Green Onions, signalling the start of our news section, and we begin as usual with jobs.
Yeah, Jigsaw Bakery in Linton is looking for a part-time bakery assistant. Hours are flexible, but are likely to include Tuesdays, Thursdays and Fridays 7 till 1pm and Saturdays 7 till 11. If you're interested, pop in from next Tuesday onwards or send Linton Jigsaw Bakery a message on Twitter or Facebook.
Charlie's Coffee Company on Burley Street needs an experienced pizza chef. Pop in for details.
The Willow Tree in Bourne, which has been selected for the Michelin UK Guide for 6 successive years, is looking for chefs. So you can give them a ring on 01954 719 775.
And if you do apply for any of these jobs, please let them know you heard about it on Flavour here on Cambridge 105 Radio. And to advertise in this space, contact sales at cambridge105.co.uk.
On to news and events now. Noel Young Wines in Trumpington are moving down the road to Great Shelford. They're opening up a wine shop and a wine bar. They'll be selling wines by the glass, carafe and bottle, along with small plates, tapas, cheeses, charcuterie and some hot dishes. It will be at 56 High Green and they'll be opening in early May.
And before they leave Trumpington, they will be having a wine sale. That will be on the 20th and the 27th of April from 10 till 7. That's in their current premises.
Also in Great Shelford, the Shelford Deli's Bistro is opening on Friday evenings. Last night was the first night. And the kitchen will be open from 5:30 to 8:30.
On the 19th of April, the Thirsty Biergarten returns. This time it will be at the back of Mackay's on East Road on Fridays, Saturdays and Sundays.
And on the 22nd of April at the Green Man in Grantchester, there is a charity 6-course tasting menu. Some of these ingredients will be foraged from Grantchester Meadows and will be paired with homemade foraged gin. The menu looks superb and the chefs include Jamie Mountford, Paolo Davis Romano from Baked by Romano and Nicola Wilkinson, pastry chef from St John's. Tickets are available from jamie.mount@icloud.com.
And finally, Seed to Feed is taking over the kitchen at Thirsty in Chesterton Road on the 26th of April from 5:30 till 10:30. To book, you can email georgia@wearethirsty.co.uk. And that's all we have time for today. We're here on alternate Saturdays at 1 p.m, repeated on Sunday at 2 p.m, and then podcast early the following week.
And if you'd like to get in touch with any news or comment when we're off the air, you can email us flavour@cambridge105.co.uk or contact us via Twitter at flavour105.
Coming up on Cambridge 105 Radio today at 2 o'clock is Bookmark Studio guest award-winning writer Jill Dawson. At 3 till 4, Community Focus with Neil Whiteside. From 4 till 5, a roundup of some of the best things you might have missed from Cambridge 105 Radio in the last week. 5 o'clock, Football Show. 6, Chris Brown's Soul and Dance Show. 8 till 9, Sweet Revenge. And from 9 till 11, Paul Cristoforo's Rock of Ages. And 11 until 1 in the morning, Club Beats. But that's all from us. Flavour will be back on the 26th of April. So until then,
goodbye.